In this episode, I speak with photojournalist, photo documentarian, activist, and member of the media collective FARPA, Christian Braga. This is the last interview that was recorded in Brazil, done in collaboration with Mina Wabi-Sabi, who set this interview up. She was the interpreter. She's the one that did the dubbing for this audio episode. And if you look in the description, you'll see a link to the video version of this episode. And she did the subtitles in English for that as well. So this is, like I said, the last interview that we conducted in Brazil. Right now I am back in the United States. But yeah, Mina and I did a lot of great work together in Brazil. So before we jump into this, I just have to really thank her for doing all that she did. We were able to pull off some really good interviews, I think, and put some good content together. None of that would have been possible without her. And so in this interview in particular with Christian, we recorded this in São Paulo. And as I mentioned, him being a photojournalist, we talk about the nature of his work. If you look in the description, I just want to say, if you're listening to this or watching this on YouTube, please go check out Christian's work so you can get an idea of just how good his eye really is, how good his photography really is, and what he's been able to capture with his work. It's something I compliment him for towards the end of the interview, but it's truly inspiring work. We wanted to really get at, in this interview, his work with indigenous groups in Brazil, as has been a theme that's come up several times in these interviews when I was down in Brazil. We talk about indigenous peoples as understanding that they are facing enormous amounts of pressure, whether it's through more subtle things like with the interview I had with Joshua Birchall, anthropologist and linguist who documents the languages that are dying, that are effectively going extinct. But in the same way with Christian, you know, documenting the various struggles, you know, for these people to demarcate land, to have their own territory, to work against these various projects. Like there was this one that he mentioned several times in this Belo Monte, which is a huge hydroelectric dam that was built, I guess it's still under construction, up in northeastern Brazil, in the area actually that I was for several weeks up with Mina when we interviewed Joshua. But that dam and all the consequences that come with building such a large-scale project has had really detrimental consequences for the people in that region. And Christian explains why that's the case, why even with all the promises that were made by the government for the construction of this dam, that, you know, it actually made things in many cases worse for the communities that surround the area. He also talks about the ways in which various illegal mining operations invade indigenous territory, and how Brazil has the highest level of environmental activists and indigenous rights activists that are killed. It's the highest in the world. And it's particularly gone up the past year or so since the election of Jair Bolsonaro, who is a far-right president of Brazil. He's in many ways encouraged with his rhetoric this type of violence towards indigenous people. As he says, his rhetoric has been anti-indigenous. And so after getting into that and explaining how these people are very, I think, courageously standing up against these projects and against long-standing colonial violence. After moving into that, you know, we talk about the nature of his work, how he and his collective approach these struggles, how they choose to represent them in media. Christian's been able to work with some really great organizations to be able to document this and help reframe the story. And, you know, there's a really famous photograph that he and a fellow member of his collective, they each took some really great photos when Lula da Silva, the former president that was falsely imprisoned under false charges, which was revealed just this past year or so, for sure, with the leaks from The Intercept. But the false imprisonment of Lula and his subsequent release this year, Christian has this just truly incredible photograph of Lula. And his comrade in the collective also took a really, really great aerial photograph of a crowd of people around Lula. It's just a truly beautiful photo, and it helped, as he explains, reframe the ways in which the international and national media of Brazil discussed his release. You know, as he said, easily people could have imagined that he was coming out, he was handcuffed, he was crying. It was like this almost shameful, sad thing. But what he demonstrated with his photography, with his photojournalism, is just people coming together and being truly emboldened and inspired by the release of this, you know, someone that's treated as a hero in many places in Brazil. You know, a controversial figure nonetheless, but nonetheless a hero. Christian, getting into that part, discusses the role that independent journalists, photographers, people who are creating content independently, the responsibilities they have in being able to direct the discussion a little bit so that the mainstream press, the national press, which have their own interests, that they don't completely take over and hijack the conversation and the narrative around these events. And it's extremely important, as he says, that when, particularly when he's working with indigenous peoples and going into their territories, their homes, that you treat them with the respect and dignity that you would want if someone were to come into your home, giving them a name, sharing their stories. And also, as he mentions near the end, actually having these people share their own stories, produce their own media is incredibly important in this time. We start to see this increase of violence towards their communities, their ability just to exist and just to survive in a time like this. You know, media has a really big responsibility in sharing these stories empathetically and accurately, giving voice to those that are oppressed. You know, often what happens is the story is told by the oppressor, by the victor, so-called conqueror. We are in a time now where we can share our stories, where the oppressed can share their stories, with the same weight as those that oppress them. It's exciting in that way. And there is something like, at least in this regard, there is hope in how we choose to take in this information, what we choose to do with it. If you want to learn more about Christian's work, I'm going to put his Instagram down below. It's Instagram, Christian Braga. You can look it up. Also look up FARPA. That's F-A-R-P-A. It's on Instagram as well. Also, the website for FARPA is Agencia FARPA. That's AgenciaFARPA.com. Go there. Even though everything's basically in Brazilian Portuguese, I mean, you go there, it's a striking, beautiful website, and you'll get to see all the various individuals that are part of this really amazing media collective and all the work that they've put together. And you know what? Go to Google Translate, put the, if you're super curious about what their manifesto is, about what their work is about, and what they've written on that website, of course you can go check out and look through Google Translate. Super amazing tool in understanding what's going on in other parts of the world from the mouths and the words of those that are writing or speaking it, right? I'll put links to everything else you need to know about this episode and about Christian down in the description of this episode, and please go check out the video. I'm proud of how that turned out. We worked pretty hard on it, so there'll be a link to that video down in the description as well. Thanks to Mina for putting this together. We did some really great work together, so Mina, thank you so much for collaborating with me, for working with me on all these episodes, and especially thank you to Christian for taking time to speak to both of us. And so without any further delay, here is our interview with Christian Braga. Christian, thank you for meeting us here in São Paulo. I wanted to just ask what your background was, you know, and what the collective that you're a part of, like what the aim of it is, what it's trying to accomplish with media in Brazil.
So I'm a photographer, a photojournalist, photo documentarian. I have worked with this for about 6-7 years. I work for an agency called FARPA, an agency that talks about human rights issues and socio-environmental issues. My trajectory, it starts, well, I can go deeper, right? So my story begins in the Amazon. Before this, I worked with photography in general. And then I started to work more specifically with resistance movements, and that was about 2013. And that's when I went for the first time. It was a manifestation, a protest about Belo Monte, which here in Brazil is a very controversial issue. We've been discussing this. It's been discussed very much. And somehow I got involved, and this was the trigger for me to get involved in this resistance movement. So it was from this discomfort, I went there and I saw these 10 people fighting in struggle, fighting for something that apparently they wouldn't have enough strength for. But that in a way really inspired me to see how human beings can resist, that in many ways we don't even have the strength to win or combat, but we still have enough strength to say no. That was just the climax, the moment when I started to get involved in other movements as well. The indigenous movement, which is in what I work for the last 6 years, in the Amazon region and in other regions of the country. Belo Monte is very well known because of this struggle that has been dealt with for a few years. It was very controversial and was a struggle relating to a very large construction, a hydroelectric dam inside the Tapajós River, which affected very much the communities that were around the area. One of them is the Unduruku peoples. It's a people that have lived there for decades and centuries. And it affected all of these people in this area. There was a huge flooding. It affected many communities. A lot of people suffered because of Belo Monte's situation. People that didn't really have an economic return or any type of security. In Belo Monte, 40,000 people arrived. They arrived to work in Belo Monte, and the city didn't really provide much good conditions for these people to live comfortably. And this resulted in a big uprising of these people against this dam. And this return is, like I said, a financial return, an infrastructure. We have a town in the area called Altamira, which receives 40,000 workers from a large infrastructure project, a national infrastructure project, and you don't give the proper conditions for this city. So in that city, started to have higher levels of crime, violence, and prostitution, drug trafficking. And many people there were uncomfortable enough to the point of meeting and creating a movement, going to the entrance of the headquarters of the Belo Monte, of a large national construction. That was the first one that I saw and participated in. And in a way, I was really inspired by that struggle. And it kick-started my trajectory.
I guess I would ask, like, the ways in which people... Because I've seen this happen in other countries where they have these big projects to build dams, and they say it's going to help the communities. But what happens is that they just completely dismiss the concerns of the people that they're supposedly supposed to be helping, right? It ends up going and being diverted to wealthier communities typically. I know this happens in India often. So, like, what are some of the promises that the government makes to these communities, and what ways do indigenous people or people in those communities react and resist these projects?
In the case of Belo Monte, the promises, I'm going to begin with Belo Monte because the promise was to structure the place around, to create structures for the community, to structure the towns, and to demarcate the lands of indigenous peoples that were in the area, and to give infrastructure and security for the population that would be affected by this project. This returning to the population a good education, returning to the community some good security, food, employment, which didn't happen. None of it happened. And in the national level, the promises made for the people in the communities and indigenous peoples of Brazil, it's for the land demarcation. I think the main demand, which is being brought forward by the national movement in Brazil, is the question of land demarcation. the struggle for the territory. In the situation of Belo Monte, the first reivindications were for the communities. The struggle of Munduruku, which was the people affected, is already a struggle that comes from years. To this day, their land hasn't been demarcated. So it's not for nothing that the Munduruku people did something that was so symbolic. For me, very symbolic. For everyone that is concerned with these questions, is that they self-demarcated their indigenous land. So what did they do? They circled around all of the area that they believed that historically, anthropologically, or of ancestral knowledge of the people and then the elders, they made their self-demarcation for themselves, since the government wouldn't do it. And they took that area as theirs. But legally, the land wasn't demarcated.
Under this kind of new presidency, has there been kind of an increase? Have you witnessed an increase of violence against indigenous communities and their ability to claim territory as their own and protect themselves against government intrusions and these projects that you're talking about? Like, I guess my question is, you know, what is the relationship currently with the Brazilian government under Bolsonaro?
I see it as indigenous resistance is a type of resistance that comes from a really long time ago, centuries. And when we say centuries, we mean since colonization. And independently of the political party and who was in power, in office, who was administrating this Brazilian government, it was never easy for indigenous struggle. It was never something chill. There might have been more effective policies in other governments. Each government dealt with it in a slightly different way. But none of them were completely beneficial for the indigenous population of Brazil. And now with Bolsonaro, for sure, it got much worse. Much worse in the sense of the rhetoric he has been building during his electoral process, during his campaign, and his own election and the people that voted for him. And it was a rhetoric, completely anti-indigenous rhetoric. And in this government, I mean, this is my perspective as a photographer, as someone who is in some way contributing to this struggle. This rhetoric created something that for some time I hadn't seen for a while. I didn't think it existed anymore for at least a few years, which is of a type of violence supported by the government. A type of violence, how can I say it? Yeah, like a legitimized violence. And this legitimized violence leads to, for example, last year, there were assassinations of some peoples and leaderships, which were symbolic during the first year of his administration. And in the Amazon, primarily, there were leaderships such as Guajajara that were assassinated. There was leadership from Guayapi in the north of the country as well. His death was also completely symbolic, representative in face of a struggle that was so strong. He was so strong there. We're not able to have a very good reading in numbers if it's better or worse. But in my view, first of all, no land was demarcated. No indigenous land was demarcated. There was this process of demarcation, which is something that every year was increasing. And two, there was an increase in violence. Nowadays, Brazil is the country that kills the most environmental leaderships, indigenous leadership in the world. This is a symbolic data, this moment we're living right now. And this is a view, I mean, I'm not a big researcher in this particular topic, but it's what I follow, it's what I live, it's what I work with nowadays. So this year there were violences, such of indigenous resistance, but also in the actual Amazon, this huge fire that happened in the Amazon that reached even São Paulo, and people in the city could follow the level, how extreme this was. The increase of these fires, which was completely legitimized by the president, Bolsonaro, who at some point in August created the day of the fire, which was the date that he allowed the rural kingpins through chats and groups that they could set fire to the Amazon. This is already something that's normal, to have fires during this period, during the drought area in the Amazon. But it dysregulated in an immense way. This affected communities and populations, indigenous peoples, and it affected who lived there. We talk about biodiversity, we talk about the forests, the animals, fauna and flora, which were affected because of the legitimation by this government. And there are things that he promised to deal with in the next few years of his administration, which were sensitive situations, which were struggles already a few years ago in the 80s. The struggle for the gold in Yanomami, something that he wants to again deal with, to allow mining in indigenous lands, which will result in immense violence. Now we have some data, which I can affirm with confidence right now because this data is not out yet, but there is data saying that approximately almost 20,000 people inside the Yanomami land mining in Yanomami. So last year I did a flyover with Greenpeace in a mining area near the Munduruku land, which later came out in the national news in the big media. It revealed that, I can't tell you the number specifically, but about 5,000 people working in mining lands. And it's a thing that Bolsonaro has already said publicly. It's a struggle that he stands in agreement with this type of mining, the mining in indigenous lands. And this is something that didn't happen yet, legally, through Congress, through law and government projects, which is a speech or a talk that he has been buying for the last few years.
Well, follow up on that, just a question on mining. I mean, so much the focus is on agribusiness, right? Industrial agriculture, burning the Amazon so they can farm soy and dairies or, cattle ranches. So mining is discussed, but I don't know if it matters to ask this question, but is this legal? I mean, is this something that's kind of given the nod from Bolsonaro, like, go ahead and do it regardless of the law? Or is this something like that's been legalized in some form?
It's illegal for you to do any type of intervention in indigenous lands. I mean, be that mining, wood extraction, extracting minerals, conservation regions are also regions where you can't have intervention. In general, intervention. So these lands we're talking about are lands that are demarcated by the government. So these are areas that for him to be able to... It's because there are things that I would rather not say. Because legally, I am not so sure about.
So with photojournalism, I mean, like, you're... I find the interesting balance here of art and objectivity, because you're photographer. I guess maybe my question is more of like how you want to approach art when it comes to documenting what's happening. There's this idea that journalism is supposed to be objective. You're not supposed to bring your own bias into it. But I think photojournalism stands apart from that just automatically. Like, you can't separate the emotional, artistic quality of it. Do you have issue with, not issue, but like, is there a difficulty in trying to accurately show an event and what's happening, but trying to create art out of it, you know, trying to elicit an emotional reaction? Like, how do you balance that in your work?
This is something that, in a way, it's empirical. We don't reflect so much on it. We don't think so much about it. I think that feeling, there is a quote that we have at FARPA in our manifesto, the agency that I'm in, together with some other four photographers. It's the unrest that moves us. And it's from this unrest that we work our context, what we do, which is to photograph. and that leaves the documentary photographic journalistic work to be and to bring it to the side of art. Art is emotion. Art is feeling. It's unrest. So we try to blend this all. It's more empirical. It's spontaneous. It's something that really moves us, and it's something we really believe in. And we let this come through in our photography. It's not necessarily a technique. It's not like a defined format, not a defined formula. And just for the fact that we expose publicly our unrest. In other words, we are the only agency that works exclusively with human rights. We don't do anything else that isn't human rights. And the question of social and environment struggles. We have a focus. I think from this focus, we are able to put all of our efforts into that work, which later comes through as a beautiful image, a symbolic image. For example, this photo that you talked about, the Lula photo, mine and the one from Francisco Prona, which mine is from the front and his is from above. And it was a photo that, in a way, the international media expected. A photo of him handcuffed, maybe from behind, crying. In a way, we portrayed that imprisonment, which we believe was an unjust process, that imprisonment. We changed the international narrative, in a way. We brought a different image, which shows that in reality, he didn't have to come out handcuffed and crying out of there. But all of this environment that we were living at that moment, it was an environment of a lot of strength. It's not for nothing that it's reflected in that image, which internationally everyone saw. It's that image of him from above and a little bit more of mine from the front.
Yeah, so with this attempt to, a successful attempt, I would say, to change the narrative around Lula's arrest and release, I mean, what political ideals are you bringing into your work? How is that being represented in your work?
My focus, since I started working, it's the question of human rights and social environmental issues. We say social environmental because we believe that inside the environment with humans, they exist in harmony. I think independently of government, the question of human rights needs to be a focus of every government, any government that comes in office, and so on, anyone who's, you know, in control of this administration. So human rights is what there must always be, independently of left and right. What I try to nowadays, I mean, I have a progressive outset. I believe in the people, in the population. I believe that we live in an unequal system. And who has a lot continues to have a lot, and who has nothing continues to have nothing. Unemployment rates are monumental. A lot of people are in need of homes. A lot of people, they need a space, they need a territory. So all of this, it's what I believe in. It's what I see of a country that I live in. It's a country that's completely unequal. In the environmental question, this government question doesn't influence as much. Even in the leftist government in Brazil, they affected the indigenous peoples in Brazil, which I didn't agree with. But now with like this right-wing administration that we have now, there are many, many projects that I don't agree with. It's difficult to align yourself with a government, with an administration, when you talk about human rights. Even so, because afterward, it ends up becoming just podium talk. No, it's the left that deals with human rights, and the right not, or vice versa. That's not really the case. I think what we have to do is, in the struggle, is that the question of human rights and these reparations happen in any government. When we talk about affirmative action, we're talking about demarcation of indigenous lands, we're talking about inequality, to end inequality. So we're talking about many projects that are beneficial for who needs it, independently of government.
Well, I was going to ask, because he had some other stories he wanted to share, things that he's working on currently. Yeah, I just wanted to ask what you're doing currently, like what current projects are you working on right now?
I have this photographic project of the last 6 years. it doesn't talk completely, of course, the indigenous movement of indigenous resistance is gigantic in Brazil. It's very big. There's a really long time that they're resisting. So I would say that it's not really a photographic project. It's my life project that I involve myself more and more in this question, in understanding the specificities each people's, understanding the different cultures. We have over 300 peoples in Brazil, each one with their own questions, their own struggles. It's really complicated. It's difficult to speak of only one indigenous movement that fights for one topic. In reality, there are like many different topics, which in some ways intersect, which is the case of the demarcation of land, indigenous land demarcation. And I was able to witness some of these struggles in the last few years, the fights in Brasilia, in São Paulo, in the Amazon, and I was able to narrate a little bit of this story, which resulted in these images that build, in a way, this imagery of indigenous resistance in Brazil. A little bit of it. More than just that, I started getting involved in some stories, bigger stories, the national story of the national struggle. But there is the specific stories, the stories of each indigenous person, in what way each one of these people struggle and they fight what they believe in. Because I also believe that in my work, what I try to accomplish in terms of what I'm doing, which is talk about the story, which is really violent, really difficult, but at the same time, it's really powerful. So as a group resists a lot, creates a lot of very powerful focal points of resistance, which are not necessarily there in Brasilia, in the capital, in front of Congress, but they're doing inside their communities really important things. And this, I mean, I'm going to give some examples. I did a documentary once for an organization, which was about the first time that an indigenous woman sings and performs inside the Amazonia Theater, which is a space that has this whole story of colonization, or the March of Indigenous Women, the first one that happened last year, or the case of Seriana Cricati, which is the first leader of indigenous brigade of firefighters, which is putting out fires in Maranhão, who leads a few groups, all men. She's the only woman, and she's the boss of that brigade. And these are some of the stories that interested me and interest me more and more. And they're not people who are necessarily in front of Congress, not even on the streets, but inside their communities. I also really like to get involved in some cultural activities inside the communities, like parties, for example. It's a very happy peoples. It's people that are very strong, really powerful. And many times you're there doing coverage of the fight, of the struggle, which is intense. And you go inside a community and you get extremely happy because you see that they have hope. There's hope. There are a lot of young people, the youth, children. Last year, in 2019, I was also in Xingu territory, which is a place that I really wanted to go to. And there I went to do coverage of a party that's 20 years of demarcation of the Kiseji land, of the Xingu region. It's a region that they lost. They were removed during colonization and during some government policies. And later they managed to demarcate the land and they celebrated this demarcation around the time of the fires of the Amazon. So you see that in there, in this region, it's a really interesting area. It's an area that they are resisting against deforestation. With reforestation, with trees for the production of piqui, of the fruit, and making piqui oil, trying to get this problem of the question of deforestation and to transform into something that will benefit not only the forest in the case of reforestation, but also a way to benefit the community, where they will also gain from this, help the local economy, making these oils, the piqui oil, and selling, and so on. That's also how you see the local initiatives and projects or ideas that you're able to combat in a way that everyone ends up winning. And these are a few of the stories in partnership with some indigenous organizations, organizations like Greenpeace, Social Environmental Institutes, these organizations that invite me to do this photographic work. Some, I'm the one who builds all of the screenplay and the plan, the idea, and I offer to some organizations or to some media. I think what I want at this time is to tell these stories and to offer these stories also. It's the story that not everyone tells. These are stories that for a really long time the media wasn't interested in covering. The true story. And in a way, now there is more of an opening to be able to involve myself more, to get involved more, to talk more about this, to go deeper into these subjects, these questions of each community, of each peoples. And in the future, I want to continue telling these stories. This year, I expect to be telling more of these stories, primarily in the Amazon, which is my area. It's an area that has interested me a lot. It's been very interesting for me to tell these stories in this region. And I think it's a region that a lot of people are going to be paying attention to right now. It's a region that's threatened. It's a region that publicly is already a target of many problems. So my idea is to tell a little bit of these stories, of these problems, and to tell stories of these initiatives that can help reverse these problems. I wanted to just tell you a little more. I was reading Ailton Krenak, and a thing that he says a lot, that Brazil is made of wars. The difference now is that this war is being documented. There are images of her. Their story is being told through images. And these stories that are recent, a story of like over 500 years, but only now, in the last few decades, that we have images that show how this violence is done in the whole world. So this is why I want to continue. I want to narrate the story so more people can see how this violence was already narrated and traced for years, years and years and centuries. They're being told and they're being continued. Now, the war isn't over yet. Many indigenous peoples are dying. There are a lot of threats being made. And the idea is to continue talking about this. Now I'm remembering. I'm starting to remember. And these are stories, all these stories that we were trying to tell. All of these stories we try to tell, in reality, it's a media war. There is a story that we tell of this version of what we were talking about earlier. The story that was told in these centuries, in these decades. These stories were always told from the perspective of the colonizer and never from who was colonized. And the idea is to reverse that and tell a little bit of the story of who was colonized. And this begins media war. And it's us speaking from here and those people there who are against all of this speaking from their side. But I've been seeing, actually, in these last few years, which gives some hope, which a lot of people are getting involved in this topic, understanding that this is part of the Brazilian culture. These are groups that have a historical culture of what is Brazil in reality, and so on, this whole process. That's it, I'm finished.
In what ways is that happening? I mean, obviously you're part of this movement. I mean, how are indigenous peoples who have had their stories told by the colonizers, I mean, in what ways are you seeing that, besides just your own work, of them telling their own stories, of getting their own perspectives and work out there?
What way people are seeing people telling their stories?
Yeah. Yeah, what other examples are there, though, that he can point to that we can look at?
There are people that truly get involved. A lot of media groups getting involved. Independent media. There's us at FAPA that work with this question of human rights. And there's a point that is very interesting, which I think has to be said. And many people, they can't just say, but you have to see. There is also the indigenous peoples telling their own stories. So I'm there as an ally in this struggle, understanding myself as white, understanding my condition, and allowing myself with the struggle of indigenous peoples. But there are also a lot of media groups that are indigenous, and they have a fantastic work. There is a filmmaker, great filmmaker, a friend of mine, Kamikia. He's an indigenous filmmaker, which tells that he narrates his own story through documentaries, through videos and clips, and so on. There are other processes that came before. For example, videos from the communities, in the communities, that tell the stories of the actual indigenous peoples. This is also, for me, a place that's very interesting. I learn a lot more when I see them telling their own stories. And as an ally, I can contribute in some way to that struggle. But the tendency that I think, not only in the indigenous movement, but any resistance movement, is that people tell their own stories. Then you can tell the story of who's suffering and not of who's attacking or of who's outside of the situation.
Okay. And so if you are working to, as an ally with these communities, to tell their stories, to be respectful and understand that they're telling their own stories and you're there to help with that, I mean, how do you do that? I mean, what kind of care do you take to do that in order to tell the stories accurately and respectfully?
First of all, is to tell the story and give them a name. Give these people their names. I think for a really long time, people treated the indigenous question and the images documented and so on as the indigenous, the people, as if all of them were one. And in reality, it's not one indigenous people. There are many different indigenous peoples. So to give them names and a place, an address, and talk about the territory of each peoples, that's already the basic, the fundamentals, which in reality is very important for them and for us, to give these people names. Where are they from? Where did they come from? Who are these people? Another aspect is to understand if they are satisfied, if they are satisfied with these images. The idea is to make an exchange. When I go inside an indigenous territory or some community or some indigenous peoples, they call me to their homes. Their indigenous territory is a home. It's their home. If I go inside their home space of where they live, their comfort, I have to have the maximum of respect in how to also tell these stories. It's the care I've been taking throughout the years of my work, which in reality isn't something forced. It's something I comprehend as honest. If I'm going inside their homes, their territory, there's nothing more fair and honest than to explain exactly what it is that I'm doing, exchanging, showing them everything that I'm doing. I get involved, they get involved, I send the final result. They like it, they share. Obviously, there are a lot of indigenous peoples that have Facebook and Instagram, and I follow them and they follow me, and we do this exchange. This is already something I see as a crucial point in my work, which I've been taking this care, but something that I put as if it was a rule for all of the people that work with this question of indigenous peoples in Brazil and outside of Brazil. The idea is also that there is a difference between my work and, I say also to my comrades and my work partners in my collective, that we get involved in the topic. So we know the people. We're friends of these people. We have relationships with these people. In a way, this helps us tell these stories, because if you work with human rights and social environmental questions, there needs to be a level of trust, an enormous level of trust. So we put the relationships as something primordial for our photographic work. And this is something that I put as a focal point in my work.
I mean, I just want to thank you for talking with me. We've been talking for like an hour almost. I don't have any other questions to ask you, but you know, your answers are just amazing, you know, and I really respect your work. It's impeccable, it's beautiful. I just have a deep respect for what you do. I just want to thank you for it. Yeah, that's all I got.
Yeah, I understood. I understood.
Thank you no final. Sabe, thank you.
Mas yeah. Eu posso, I can finish, I guess, then.
Então, né? Closing. Yeah, please. Yeah, whatever else you want to say, please.
So that's it. The movements continue to resist. not only indigenous peoples, but the landless workers movement, groups of Amazonian resistance, the riverside communities, the quilombolas, the quilombos, indigenous peoples, yes, and so on. Groups that aren't resisting now, but are resisting for years, that are telling their stories, which now, during this government, which is a government that has as a policy to attack these groups, so potentially will live moments of resistance. They're very strong now. Latin America has risen since last year in a way that's massive and unprecedented. Chile had huge manifestations. Peru had a lot of manifestations as well. Bolivia had large manifestations. To raise these questions, to make demands, to demand a world a little bit more progressive, that respects diversity of cultures, that respects the diversity of thought, that respects diversity of belief. So that's what we are going to do, and these stories. The idea is that these stories are being told very carefully, with a lot of care, with a lot of attention. So many stories of struggle, stories of resistance, stories in a way also about loss, but also the stories of winning. So the idea is that these resistance images have their turn, that people can, in their homes, in their everyday lives. So in many ways, it's really difficult to follow in independent media. A lot of people have just more access to mainstream media, the Brazilian traditional media. So the idea is to also put these stories in this press, on TV, on the radio, on the internet, make so that these stories reach more and more people. I believe we have this progress very strong, that's of massive proportions. For instance, question of feminism, such as the indigenous genocide, which took massive magnitudes this year, such as the question of the Amazon. So I see that it's a difficult moment, but I also see a moment that a lot of people are opening their eyes for something better. I believe in a better world. So we go on doing what we like to do and doing what we believe in, which is all of this that I've been talking about in all of this interview.
E obrigado.
Obrigado. Thank you. All right. Good.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about this podcast, go to the website lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be on that website. If you would like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, and you can treat that a bit like a tip jar. If you like this episode or any other episode of this podcast in particular, consider throwing a few bucks Patrick's way. That would be really helpful. And if you would really like to sustain this work and support this project more regularly, consider supporting this project through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness and donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month. And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release. If you'd like to drop Patrick a line and have your message featured, there are two ways to do that. For those in the United States, you can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a voicemail message up to 3 minutes in length. Or you can drop an audio file by following the instructions through the link in the description of this episode. As the great psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it. That's it. That's all you sent me.
Yeah, that's it.
Do you want me to say anything else? Last Born in the Wilderness is quality content that can truly improve the way that you see the world and the way that you think about yourself.